I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. The Waco disaster by now has a lot of the hallmarks of a classic Clinton bungle. Government stonewalling, a lively dogfight between cabinet officials, possible cover-up, lots of politics and spin. That's why the conservatives and the Wall Street Journal love this story. But the fascination with Janet Reno and Louis Spree, who are in the media crosshairs now, might just be a distraction. They were barely into their respective jobs at the start of the Waco siege, after all. Lots of people, and not just the conspiracy theorists, have been unhappy with the government's explanation of what happened at the Branch Davidian complex 6 years ago. 80 people, about 25 of them children, died in the fire there. Anger over Waco is said to be what motivated Timothy McVeigh to blow up a federal building in Oklahoma City 4 years ago, 4 years later. This hour, we're revisiting the Waco story. Dr. Alan Stone of the Harvard Law School and the Harvard Medical School is our guest. He was part of a Justice Department review panel to prevent more Wacos in the future. He published his own dissenting report on that committee. Also joining us by phone is Dick Revis, who's the author of a book called The Ashes of Waco, an Investigation. Connection listeners, we're interested in just the facts this hour. What happened and why? Where do you feel you've been getting the truth from? Such truth as we have. What is the essential truth of this story? 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK makes the Waco connection. I'd like to start with you, Alan Stone. Huge controversy here and many big questions. In your own head, what are the most important unanswered questions?
Well, for me, the unanswered questions center around not just the last day, which is what the current investigation proposes to look at. Did our people, the government's people, actually fire bullets into the compound? Did they use canisters that might have set the fire unwittingly? Those questions are important, but there are others equally troubling about the last day and about the very beginning of this tragedy. Most people have trouble keeping it straight that the raid initially was by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And when we assembled, the panel assembled in the Justice Department on July 1st, 1993, a few months after the tragedy, we never, to my mind, were given an adequate explanation of why this raid ever occurred in the first place. I hope Americans are going to get an answer to that question. As for the new questions about shooting into the compound, let me say this, that we were given autopsy reports, or at least I was. I insisted on not filing my report until I'd seen the factual investigation. And the factual investigation was very disappointing. But in the factual investigation, it reported that 20 plus members of the Branch Davidians died of bullet wounds. In only a few of the cases did they report that they were bullet wounds at close range. David Koresh himself was shot in the forehead, between the eyes, someone told me. Now, to this date, I've never had a good, solid explanation of all these deaths. The FBI told us they didn't fire a shot and that the Branch Davidians must have killed themselves. Now there's a real question about that.
You wrote in the Wall Street Journal this week, I must say, a remarkably arresting piece, that as a member of the panel, you had been asked basically to come to a judgment or confirm their judgment without seeing the facts. And you said that, and you are a physician, you felt you'd been asked to render a diagnosis and prescription without being allowed to take a history or examine the patient. How in the world did these people, they were, I mean, clearly smart people, relatively young in their jobs at this point, think they could avoid pursuing these obvious inquiries, like how did David Koresh die of a shot between the eyes, if indeed he did? I mean, why wasn't that, first, let's get the facts, why wasn't that the rule?
Well, the Justice Department had drawn a wall, erected a wall between our panel and the factual investigation. And they said, basically, we're not going to reveal any facts to you people until the investigation is complete. And I kept saying, well, how are we to tell you what you did wrong so you can avoid it in the future if you're not going to tell us what you did? But there's a sort of an element to it that I would like to convey to you, which I found very troubling. We were assembled there in the Justice Department, and I asked the people there from the FBI, what did you do wrong? What should you do differently next time? And they went around the table, and they said, nothing. Nobody was prepared to admit that they'd done anything wrong or they should do anything differently. And Janet Reno has basically adopted that same position. She has said, you know, it was a terrible tragedy, but we didn't do anything wrong. I take responsibility for whatever happened, but we didn't do anything wrong. Now, I have thought from the very beginning that she didn't fully understand what she was taking responsibility for. And now, when she hears that there were potentially incendiary weapons used, she is beginning to worry herself, I think, that maybe there are things that she took responsibility for that she never knew about.
Dick Revis wrote a book on all this, The Ashes of Waco, an Investigation. Dick, welcome to The Connection. Give us your own sort of executive summary, if you can, of the most important facts in this controversy.
It might take a long time to do that. I think the general pattern is this. Both the ATF and the FBI went at this operation in a less than professional manner, not to the highest quality work standards. There were various errors. When anyone questioned these errors, the government either said nothing or issued denials. And so at this point, we're now beginning to, layer by layer, peel back this foul-smelling onion that was Waco in 1993. There was, what's the word, at a minimum, just negligent behavior by both agencies.
Negligent in this case meaning what? I mean, they're there on the alert, but what do you mean by negligence?
Well, negligent, for example, is when they shot all of the tear gas into that building in quantities sufficient to cause very severe physiological reactions, especially on a part of the children. And the tear gas they used was the CS powder. It is mixed with a chemical called methylene chloride, which is an ingredient of paint thinners, and the standard manuals for handling chemicals say don't use this stuff indoors, it poses a fire and explosion hazard. And so I have always been afraid that what happened was they created an atmosphere inside parts of that building that was primed for anything to set it off into a fire, whether intentional or not intentional. You set up a danger and then it happens.
To call it negligence is one thing. What if they meant to do it? What if that was the plan? What if they thought they were on a military mission, and just had the wrong battle plan?
I don't think that there was any central plan to kill the people in Mount Carmel. I don't think such a thing could have been put forth. It may be that there were two or three rogue agents who, on the morning of the 19th, picked up canisters that were incendiary and shot them in. That could have happened. Also, what could have happened is this. They had in their tanks both non-incendiary ferret rounds and incendiary military rounds of three types: military gas grenades, flares, and high explosive devices. And all four of these types of ammunition fit the same grenade launcher. So you're an FBI man, you're sitting in a tank, you're shooting ferret rounds hot and heavy, the record shows that. You reach to reload, and maybe you reach into the wrong box. All the ammunition fits the same gun, and you accidentally fire an incendiary round. Given the atmosphere you've created in that building with the methylene chloride, the building goes up. And so mistakes are made by everybody. In most fields of work, when the subordinate makes a mistake, he does not report it to his superior. I don't know why we think that the rules would be any different in the FBI. The FBI is human.
My view is
Alan Stone.
That it would be a big mistake to suggest that anyone in the government did this on purpose, or that anybody wanted to kill the Branch Davidians. I don't think so. I think the tragedy is that the ATF did what they did as an incredible publicity stunt, in which they had notified the television people in advance, you know, come watch us do this dynamic entry, as they called it, on the Branch Davidians. You can televise it, and we're going to capture all these guns. And as a result, they created a tragic situation. I cannot tell you the reckless stupidity of the ATF. It goes beyond negligence. I mean, I think it's clear that they lied to Governor Richards of Texas, telling her that there were drugs inside, and the Branch Davidians, who are derived from the Seventh-day Adventists, are not into drugs of any kind. So this was wholly untrue. I don't think that the FBI had any intention of killing the people. I don't think that Janet Reno would have approved any plan that would even have risked the children. And that has been what's troubling me. Particularly, I believe she was misled about the risks to the children of this approach of the gas. Based on my own experience, I think that much gas that they intended to use would have killed the children, even if the fire hadn't broken out.
What was the chain of command here, and did it break down?
The chain of command was very hard to describe. Agent Jamar was in charge on the ground. There was another base about 25 miles away at an airfield, and then there was a central operating room in Washington. Commands were coming from all these places. In the course of the siege, Jamar admitted that there was friction between his tactical people, who wanted to do something and get those Branch Davidians out, and the behavioral negotiation people, who kept telling him, look, we should negotiate. These people are religious fanatics. If we keep pressuring them, we'll drive them to suicide.
How much of the problem was a kind of interagency rivalry? They had different weapons. Some had helicopters. Some were prepared on the ground. They had different analyses. They had different leadership, different relations to the cabinet, different relations to the president as the kind of chief of the U.S. government.
Well, the ATF raid, to begin with, was okayed by an acting assistant secretary of treasury. He hadn't even been named at that point, right? And the ATF got their helicopters from the state of Texas. They didn't have helicopters, right? Mm-hmm. So that whole part of the operation ought to be kept separate from what followed after their tragedy, in which four of their agents got killed needlessly, in my view. The FBI took over during the siege that followed. So I think the ATF was particularly reckless. I think the FBI tried to do a good job, but as the days passed and we got to 51 days, there was huge pressure on them, tension within the ranks of the FBI about how to handle it. And then finally, the do something people took over and pushed for this tank gas assault. However, I think we're leaving out an important ingredient that I'm concerned about at this point. There's the ATF, there's the FBI. But all through the initial raid, the siege, and the final day, there were military advisors involved. I never was informed about any investigation of what those military advisors did. I have been asking repeatedly since the beginning, who drove those tanks? Are there FBI who are trained to drive tanks? How much military involvement was there? Those are questions that I think have never been answered, and I suspect were redacted from the investigation report.
Dick Revis, how many of them do you feel are still outstanding? And how many of the questions did you managed to answer yourself?
I would think that most of the questions are outstanding. What I attempted to do in my book was to indict the credibility of the government's version of what happened, to lay out all of these contradictions and evidence of lies, and to say, this thing needs to be investigated. My feeling was that the press didn't do its job during the 51 days or afterwards, that it did not investigate on its own. And my book was in many ways a call to the press to get to the bottom of the thing. Hmm. And I provide in the book dozens of leads to things that ought to be looked at. And so I would think that we should start from a blank tablet. What I think will happen is that if Mr. Danforth finds disturbing information about the April 19th raid, then there will be a call for looking at the rest of it.
Dick, what is your own explanation of why the Clinton administration has been so kind of relentless in what sounds like a cover-up, or at least cover up something, cover their own butts here?
I don't think it's because they know what happened. Let me describe sort of a difficult scenario. In this country, we've had lynchings ever since we started on the Indians. In the South, in the 20s, we had lots of them. And some of them began when a group of people decided not to kill anybody, but to scare the wits out of them, to punish them in that way. So you mount the man who you suspect on a horse, in this case David Koresh, you put a rope around his neck, you tie it to the tree, but you don't tell the horse to run off. A lynch mob gathers, the public, and it starts saying, as happened at Waco, get the monster, go get him, go get him. And at some point, somebody hits the horse, or the horse gets spooked, or a car backfires and scares the horse runs off. And all of a sudden, you've lynched a man. He's dead. This is roughly what I think happened at Waco. And when Koresh was killed, 80% of the people, the polls show, 80% of the people in this country said he was solely responsible. The FBI, through its press conferences, had said Koresh was a monster, and the people had responded, go get him. Get the monster. So that both Clinton and Reno hit a peak of popularity right after the Waco incident. They had killed the monster. Now, when you're a politician, it's very hard to investigate the basis of your own popularity. You don't want to do that. You want to rest on your record. That's roughly the scenario I think we've got here.
Dick Rivers, thank you, and stand by. Alan Stone, does that make sense to you?
Part of it makes sense to me. I honestly believe that Janet Reno thought an investigation had been done, even though this investigation, in effect, said the operation was a success, but 80 people died. Basically, you didn't do anything wrong. And she stood by that, and so has the Clinton administration. So they've had no reason to look deeper. It's other people like Dick Revis who have been looking, and like myself, who have been complaining about this for years now.
Yeah, and in meantime, lots of crazy people have been driven to extreme action, like Timothy McVeigh, and lots of people in the center and toward the right have been driven to the wall by perversely obsessive stonewall against simple airing of facts here. You wonder why.
I quite agree. And my wondering, I constantly find, since I tend to be a liberal Democrat, that all of my friends are very antagonistic about my sympathy for the Branch Davidians. Because whatever David Koresh was, as soon as you look into this, as Dick Revis has and I have, you find that the people inside the compound were decent, religious people. Most of them had nothing to do with the buying and selling of guns or the shooting of guns. They were there as members of a religious sect about which they felt deeply. People don't realize that there were Branch Davidians had gathered from all around the world. that a third of the people inside were people of color, that a graduate of the Harvard Law School was actually one of the people inside the compound. Strange. We can't seem to... They've been so demonized that people are afraid if we are sympathetic to them, then the right-wing people, the paranoid people, will somehow feel they have been reinforced.
And a number of people who have tried relentlessly to get the facts have been tarred with the brush of paranoia or fanaticism. Have you experienced that, Dick Rivers?
Most certainly. I was unemployable roughly from the time, from 1995, from when my book came out, until 2 weeks ago, until this thing came back. Because I was regarded by people who had not read my book as a conspiracist.
Hmm.
This is a good journalist who went crazy. That was the line on me.
Who are the neo-McCarthyists who are touting that line?
The press. My peers.
Like, for example?
The Dallas Morning News. I mean, different places, the word gets back to me what people are saying about me when I apply for jobs. And it was just something I had to live with, and frankly, I never believed that I would see the day when this thing would be reexamined. I thought I just had to, what's the word, live with that. And the problem here we have is that the press runs by consensus.
Mm-hmm.
There is no bottom line. If the consensus in 1993 is that Koresh was a monster who had to be killed off, and it was a good thing we did it, that passes for truth, unless somebody investigates it. And so there was that point of view on the part of most journalists who, and I have to put this in quote, tried to cover that story. They were not in any position then to do their jobs. They couldn't get the story, but they reported that they were getting it. So when my feeling is that when this thing is all shaken out, there's enough blame for everybody. It's not just Janet Reno, if her at all. It's not just the FBI. It's also the press, which should look at its own house and its own procedures.
Yeah, it's a very interesting and rather disquieting point that the press can spend a year sort of hanging Bill Clinton for his sexual peccadilloes and not lift really a serious finger on the question of what did happen at Waco, Texas. We're talking about the examination of the case here on The Connection from WBUR, Boston. Alan Stone, our guest, was on the Justice Department's review panel, published his own dissenting piece about it. Dick Rivers wrote the book, The Ashes of Waco, An Investigation. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Hello, David. David, welcome.
Yeah, if my voice shakes a little, it's because this issue really makes me very angry when I think about it. I want to thank you, Chris, for mentioning the children. I know that the more I hear about it, the Waco situation, people forget that there were children there. I think one reason is because a lot of those children, I believe, were children of David Koresh. And unfortunately, the typical American family didn't see those children as typical American children, so their deaths were really acceptable. And Alan Stone, I think the phrase reckless stupidity beyond negligence really hits the nail. Janet Reno gave her okay to a plan to assault a Davidian compound, fill it up with smoke, and for David Koresh to then gather his people and tell them that his apocalyptic teachings were all false and that they were going to surrender. You don't have to be Aristotle to know that that wasn't going to happen. First of all, it wouldn't be physically possible for them to have that surrender meeting with all that smoke. Also, Koresh and the Davidians had already fired on the ATF. We know that he was preaching an apocalyptic end. So what it comes down to me is an issue of stupidity. And I think we have to start using stupidity as an acceptable reason to demand resignation. Right now, Senator Danforth is already starting, I think, another smokescreen here because he's talking about, he says specifically there are only two issues we're going to look at. Was a fire started by FBI, and was there a cover-up? And he said on McNeil Lehrer last night, we're not going to look at judgment calls. And it is all about a judgment call. It was about that stupid decision to fill that place up with smoke. I just think that Janet Reno needs to go. And one last point is that we have never heard anything about their other ideas. As I was watching the siege on television, it occurred to me, why doesn't somebody ask Reverend Jesse Jackson to step in? Why don't we shut off the sounds of the rabbits being slaughtered, let those people get a good night's sleep, and send in Jesse Jackson and see what happens?
David, I mean, that's possible. You could also send Jimmy Carter, but these are kind of cliches, too. I like your idea in the Wall Street Journal, Alan Stone, to pardon the seven Branch Davidians that are still in prison on various... Yes. Were they honestly convicted?
It's a very troubling trial. Actually, Dick Revis has reported on it very well. What the judge did is, I feel, to overturn the verdict of the jury. I think they should get out on appeal. I actually have been writing to them for the last 2 years and trying to get them pardoned without...
It might be easier than forcing resignations here, but we'll see. We're talking about the Waco case. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Anderson Consulting, a global management and technology consulting firm whose mission is to help its clients create their future on the web at ac.com. And by the Heller Graduate School at Brandeis University, offering an MBA degree for health and human service professionals, 781-736-3820.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fidelity Investments, managing the U Fund College Investing Plan, a program of the Massachusetts Education Financing Authority, 1-800-FIDELITY. The Boston Bean Coffee Company, purveyors of fine coffee equipment and service to the workplace, an exclusive distributor of Peet's Coffee and Teas, California's dark roast company. In the weather forecast for today, lots of rain on and off throughout the afternoon, and there will be rain tonight as well. It should end by tomorrow morning. There is a chance of a morning shower, then partly cloudy skies, high 70 to 75. On Sunday, fair skies, a high around 70. Other WBUR supporters include Adesso, adjoining the Four Seasons Hotel, featuring the Ligne Rose Furniture Collection, now open 7 days a week, 451-2212, or on the web at adesso-boston.com. And by the new Bank Boston Pavilion, welcoming B.B. King and the 1999 Blues Festival on September 14th. Tickets at 617-931-2000. In sports action tonight, the Red Sox open up a three-game series with the Yankees at the stadium in the Bronx. Andy Pettit for the Yanks against Pedro Martinez, seeking his 21st win of the year for Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Jill Kaufman. If you've been thinking about WBUR's Citizens of the World Tour of Romania in late September, it's time to reserve your space now because there are just two seats left. Fall in Romania is full of tradition, colors, and culture, and the trip will include festivals, tours of ancient monasteries, and side trips to Transylvania and Vienna. Join BBC and NPR correspondents for the trip of a lifetime. Call 1-800-909-9287, and thanks.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Waco connection with the Harvard Law professor, who's also an MD and psychiatrist, Alan Stone, and the author, Dick Revis, who wrote the book, The Ashes of Waco, An Investigation. Before we go further on unanswered questions and unresolved facts, Dick Revis, would you just remind us, and Alan Stone, leap in too, if indeed the Branch Davidians were an eccentric but harmless religious sect, why did the Treasury Department's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the FBI go in there as if against Saddam Hussein in the first place?
The first answer is that we don't know because they won't tell us. The Freedom of Information request that I filed in December of 1993 have not yet been answered. The second answer is that we can speculate. given the lack of words from the horse's mouth, we have to speculate. And what we find is that the ATF was in trouble. Its agents, who were female, and another group of agents who were black, had filed suit against the agency for racial and sexual discrimination. The ATF had a budget hearing coming up, and the Congress at that point was dominated by Democrats, and it didn't look good for the ATF. Apparently, someone in the ATF thought, we will raid this group of white fundamentalist gun-toting Christians, and we will film our raid, and we will show it at the budget hearing, and the Democrats will love us. Once that raid went bad, it's kind of like the first shot in the war. Who knows who fires it? The rest is revenge. Once that happened, everything was set up.
Alan Stone.
Well, I think I know a little more about it from what was told me in briefings and discussions with people in the Treasury Department. I do think that there was an effort by the ATF to sort of show how good they were. That was part of it. I think they did find out...
Specifically for hearings and budgetary renewal?
Whatever the timing is, let me emphasize that I try to stay away from imputing exact motives to people. Let me say that their involvement with the Branch Davidians of trying to find out what was going on goes back months and months and months before. Now, they might very well have decided now's the time to do it and get the publicity. But they had been looking into the Branch Davidians for some time. Now, I just want to emphasize that these people were not sort of right-wing militia types. The Branch Davidians were certainly not. Most of the guns they had, they were buying to resell. And much of the other military equipment they bought had no military value. I mean, like Second World War grenades that they were buying to sell at gun shows that people put on their, over their fireplaces. Mm-hmm. So I think there was nonetheless a sense, we're going to go in there, there's going to be television, and we are going to pull off this great raid and capture all these guns. That's what they were trying to do. They were told that Koresh knew they were coming. At that point, they were supposed to call off the raid, and they didn't. That strikes me as the most reckless, incredible blunder. I want you probably remember, I think every American remembers, those ATF agents going up on the roof. Now, the reason those ATF agents were going up on the roof is because the plan said there's a locked armory on the second floor, and we get there by surprise. We go up into the roof, and we go into those windows because that's where the armory is. So they lose the element of surprise. They're already in a firefight, and those poor agents are going up onto the roof, getting shot and killed, trying to get into a window where if they're being shot, they know there's no longer any armory in there. So the stupidity and futility of our ATF in getting its own agents killed, I think that has never been appreciated. Now, let me just correct one thing that you said. I don't think you should think that they went in together, the ATF and the FBI. The ATF...
No.
Yes. The ATF had this tragedy. The FBI then took over. And for days, I think the FBI tried to deal with it reasonably. But they were met by the press who every day on television, it would say, day 32. And the FBI has done nothing. It was just like the Iran hostages all over again, right? So there was tremendous pressure on the FBI to do something and on the Clinton administration to do something.
You know, the last caller before the break kind of disparaged John Danforth's effort here. What's your hope for a fresh investigation by a smart Republican former senator from Missouri?
My hope is that he'll actually get the people involved at the time who made the decisions on the ground, just the people Dick Revis was talking about, who may have done things and then didn't report it. I also hope he's going to look at whether the first raid by the ATF was justified. I also hope he's going to tell us where the bullets came from that killed the Branch Davidians. I also hope he's going to tell us whether he thinks that the FBI's tactics drove the Branch Davidians to mass suicide if they weren't shot, in fact, by our people.
Is he going to have better access to facts than you did, Dr. Stone?
I think the problem is this. The same people who spoke to me candidly, I sat behind them in the hearing rooms of Congress when they testified to Congress, and they had massaged and manipulated their stories. Now, you have to realize that one of the deep problems here is that all those people are being sued for billions of dollars in damages. So is he going to be able to get the truth from people if that truth is going to mean you're liable for $1 billion in damages?
Don't you wonder? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Waco connection. Chris is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, I'd just like to ask your guests, what role is the Texas Ranger investigation going to have in the upcoming independent counsel investigation with Senator Danforth? And if that investigation is just trivial in the whole scheme of this fiasco.
Dick Revis, do you want to leap in?
Yes, I don't think we know at this point what role the investigation the Rangers are conducting will have, but we do know the terrain. And the terrain is this. The FBI admitted to the Rangers or conceded to the Rangers that they had authority, that the Rangers had authority to investigate murder in Texas. And so the Rangers, theoretically, were supposed to investigate what happened at Waco. The FBI treated them like red-headed stepchildren. The Rangers felt offended and abused, and they've been smoldering for years. Now they want to show that they, too, are a law enforcement agency and that they're not afraid to talk about what they find. So I suspect that the Rangers will produce something significant. But they're not working for the federal government. They're working for the state of Texas. They're not working for Danforth. They're working for the people here.
I think there's just one thing I would add. The Texas Rangers have in their possession a lot of physical evidence. And that may be very important.
1-800-423-8255. Chris, thank you. 1-800-423-TALK makes the Waco connection. Sue is on the line.
Hi, maybe you could help me understand this a little bit better. We keep hearing about Janet Reno, but I may have missed this, but I haven't heard much about Louis Free. What was his responsibility in all of this, and how much was Janet Reno depending on his judgment for all of this?
Well, let me set you straight about that. It's very important to realize that Louis Free was a sitting federal judge while all this was going on. He had nothing to do with what actually happened at Waco. He made no decisions at Waco. He was appointed director of the FBI months after Waco had happened. So blaming Louis Free for what happened is strange. I believe blaming Janet Reno for what happened is also strange, because at most she's at first said, no, I'm worried about this plan, it might harm the children. Someone reassured her, I believe falsely, and she gave her okay. And since then she's been taking the hits, like, I was the captain of the ship, if anything went wrong I gave my consent. But I don't think she knew what she was taking responsibility for. But I do not think that Louis Free made any decisions. And I don't think the then head of the FBI made any decisions either, because he was already in bad odor and was on his way out.
If she's taking the hit for somebody else, who is the somebody else?
Well, the person who offered her his resignation 2 weeks after is Webb Hubble.
I would agree with Dr. Stone about Janet Reno's role in this. I think she was a new attorney general, had been on the job less than 6 weeks. She's confronted with all these macho military types. They're insisting they have to do something. She raised legitimate questions. She says, why can't we wait till the people in Mount Carmel run out of water? A very sane strategy. And they threw smoke and mirrors at her. And so I think that from everything I can see, she has thus far acted in good conscience.
I agree with that.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Waco connection. Jessica is calling from a car phone.
Hi. My question is pretty simple. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of criticism, what shouldn't have been done, and this and that. I'm wondering what you think should have been done.
Well,
good question.
First of all, I think the ATF raid, to begin with, never should have happened. I think that the people who gave consent for that raid to happen should be made to explain why. I don't think it was necessary. The sheriff, the local sheriff, said that they could have served whatever warrants or legal papers they had to serve peaceably. There was no need for this raid at all. That's the first thing that should have been done. The second thing that should have been done by the FBI was just to wait. There's no need to risk the lives of women and children who clearly are innocent in order to bring this to a close. They could have just waited. So there are good answers. And let me say that the FBI had been given that strategy by their own people. That's not me after the fact telling the FBI what they should have done. Their own negotiation people told them, let's just wait.
Dick Revis, what should have happened here?
I think I would agree with what Dr. Stone has said. I want to point out something here. You know, on January the 1st of 1994, Subcomandante Marcos and his guerrillas took over great sections of the state of Chiapas, far bigger than Mount Carmel, and declared themselves in rebellion until the death against the Mexican government. The Mexican government's response was, well, gee, we can't dislodge Marcos because in those villages he holds, they're children. They're going to be innocents killed if we do this. And it's been how many years now? More than five, that the Mexican government has had a perimeter around Chiapas and is sitting there waiting. That government hasn't fallen. It hasn't lost face. It believes that it's not expensive to wait, and the FBI could have waited as much as the Mexicans could. There's a lot of talk in this country about family values. One family value is you value the lives of children. Our agencies didn't show the respect that our neighbors to the south have shown since the Marcos Rebellion.
That's deep. Stand by, Dick Revis. We're talking about Waco on the connection and the reinvestigation of what pretty much everybody knows now was a monstrous bungle. 1-800-423-TALK. Dan is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Dan. Welcome.
Just wanted to give you a call. There seems to be a reluctance on the part of a lot of people to accept the fact that the FBI could have just plain set this place on fire. I simply want to bring up the fact that this is the same agency that gave the green light to a sniper to shoot an innocent woman holding a baby at what they now call Ruby Ridge. So please do not underestimate the FBI's willingness and the culture of unnecessary violence that is entrenched in that organization. And I guess that's all I wanted to say.
May I say something?
Dick Revis, please.
That same sniper, Lon Horiuchi, was on duty at Waco April the 19th. And there is a 302 or an after-action report saying that they heard gunfire from the place where he was. Now, I don't want to say that Lon Horiuchi even fired that day, but I think we should ask, what was he doing on duty with a rifle while the dust still hadn't cleared over Ruby Ridge?
Hmm. Let me ask you, Dick Revis and Alan Stone, is it your own judgment that we'll come to believe in the end that it was the FBI who started that fire? I mean, that, to get very simple about it, in the end, what will we decide about how the fire started? Where will the FBI be? Alan Stone.
Well, when we met to be briefed, the FBI told us that they had listening devices inside the compound, that they had heard something like a discussion among the Branch Davidians saying that David says we're to step out on the surface of the sun. That's what they told us. Now, I've never heard those tapes. I've never seen a typescript of those tapes.
The meaning that we're bound for eternity here?
Yes.
And nobody gets out alive?
Exactly. So that's what they told us. Now, I believe that it will be very hard to answer this question, and that perhaps we will never know who set the fire. But I still have enough confidence in our government and in the FBI that I do not believe that the FBI intended...
I didn't say intended to start the fire, but did.
I don't think we'll ever know. I do know that...
Let me just say this is the connection from WBUR Boston.
So I do know that the tank started leveling the compound, departing from the plan that had been agreed upon with Janet Reno. So that people might have been crushed to death by actions of those tanks and the FBI, that people might have died inadvertently, I certainly think is possible.
Dick Revis, what will the judgment be finally about who started the fire?
I don't think we know, and I think it's an error to focus on the question of ignition. The fire could have started accidentally under the circumstances I've described, which where there was negligence for the FBI. I would say about the tapes Dr. Stone has mentioned, I have heard them, and they are audio inkblot test. You can hear anything you want.
Right.
The quality is so poor. And I've seen two sets of transcripts, one of which says they're saying set the fire, and the other of which they're saying things entirely different. I don't believe those are good evidence for any thesis.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Waco connection. Betsy is calling from Lincoln, Rhode Island.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Betsy.
I have a small comment to make and then a question. I lived in Waco, Texas for 10 years before, and I left the year before this happened. Hmm. And it... I never lived in a area where the religious, it had a unique religious flavor in that part of the country. And well, my question regards that, if the people making decisions had enough schooling in religion and to make wise decisions based on Koresh's apocalyptic, you know, vision, if they took that into account enough. But the one other comment was that people always say this happened in Waco, and it did not happen in Waco. I just feel, for Waco's sake, that it was outside of Waco, is in the country. That aside, I mean, it's a minor thing, but it's kind of gives Waco a face that it doesn't deserve.
Did you ever hear of these people, Betsy? And I'm dying to ask you what you would have done about them on what you had heard.
I had heard about them years before in the paper, that they lived in different parts of the... that they had some feud with some other leader years ago, and they were just kind of a small note in the paper occasionally with some small thing. It wasn't any big deal. They weren't part of the culture. Yeah, you know, I didn't hear about them, and except for this one newspaper thing years ago. So they were not part of the regular Waco scene or whatever. They were just an outside... You know, I just learned about it after it happened. I really didn't know they existed in this big compound out of town, but it was way out of town. But the religious mindset of Texas, of the Bible Belt, or whatever you want to call it, I mean, people have strong feelings about their religion, and they really believe it. And if the people are making decisions on tactical of going in based on what they think people like this would do, They better have their mind straight on what those people, you know, how strongly they believe what they believe. And I was just wondering if the people with the FBI or whoever making those decisions were coming from Washington, or if they were making consultations with religious experts or whatever.
Well, Stone, I will forever after now refer to this as outside Waco. I agree entirely with you. One of our chief criticisms was that the FBI did not bring in people who understood the religious beliefs of the Branch Davidians to act as third-party negotiators, even though that very strategy of using people who understood the group had worked on a previous occasion the FBI refused to bring in a group of people or a person who understood the religious beliefs of David Koresh to negotiate.
Dick Revis, you get the last word.
Not only did the FBI refuse to bring in people, but when people came to them, Dr. Tabor and Arnold, theologians, the FBI refused to use their services. So there was no one among the negotiators who understood Seventh-day Adventist ideology, and David Koresh was a radical Seventh-day Adventist.
It is one strange, sad case, and kind of an appalling mystery why it is 6 years later that we're still looking for fundamental facts. Dick Revis, congratulations to you for the guts to go into a very shall we say, upstream investigation and to stick with it. Thank you enormously. Dick Revis's book is called The Ashes of Waco, an Investigation. And thank you to you, Alan Stone, for hanging tough and not being swerved on that Justice Department commission. Dr. Alan Stone is a medical doctor who teaches at the Harvard Law School in Cambridge. Thank you both. We had help today from George Hicks, Jim Norris, Lindsay Miller, Sheila Hulsor, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Louis Cronin, Hitesh Hathi, Keith Shields, John Holt, Amy McDonald, and our senior producer, Mary McGrath. We brace ourselves now for a temporary absence of Jill Kaufman, who's our voice on the Connection phone, brilliant and tireless producer, best friend and mother of us all on the Connection. She's off to the boondocks to fill in for the Chris Lydon of New Hampshire Public Radio. So au revoir, Jill. Good luck. We'll see you in March. Thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Delphi Forums, providing leading websites, companies, and individuals a full suite of services to create successful online communities. On the web at www.delphi.com. And by Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, counselors at law, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Schneider Leasing Company, offering rentals, leasing, and networking of computer equipment for businesses throughout New England. John Harvard's Brewhouse, serving authentic English lagers and ales along with decidedly un-English food, like old-fashioned chicken pot pie in Harvard Square and Framingham. And by Radcliffe Seminars, where busy adults can pursue part-time study in liberal arts, landscape design, management and career and financial planning, on the web at radcliffe.edu. It's 73 degrees in Greater Boston. This is WBUR.
Ira Jackson, Executive Vice President of Bank Boston, a WBUR underwriter.
We at Bank Boston have been underwriting WBUR for more than a decade, and I'm proud to say that during that entire 10-year period, we've used our underwriting spots to showcase our partners in the community. It's a nice reflection on our own values.
Underwriting on WBUR says a lot for your business. For more information, call 353-8451. That's 353-8451.
From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston and 1240 WBUR-AM West Yarmouth. Also broadcasting on 91.5 WSDH Sandwich and 90.3 WCCT Harwich. WBUR, Boston, Cape Cod, and the Islands. Funding for Here and Now is provided by Tweeter with a large selection of DVD players from well-known brands. DVD players are available now at all Tweeter locations.
It's 12 noon. Massachusetts gets a new improved sex registry law just in time to meet the deadline for federal funding. I'm Jason Beaubien.
I'm Bruce Gellerman. We're asking, is the new sex registry legislation any better than the old? Here and now.
The new law allows the state to lock up sex offenders indefinitely, even after they've served their prison sentences. We have the details.
Also, we visit with a stay-at-home mom.
Americans love to labor, but what is lost? We conclude our week-long look at the world of work with a discussion about the overworked American and work life Italian style.
New England editors and reporters wrap up the week in regional news.
Bill Littlefield raps about the weekend's sporting events.
and 50 flicks in 10 days. We preview the Boston Film Festival.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
First, this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says it's clear Indonesia's military has been involved in this week's violence in East Timor. In a statement issued from aboard Air Force One, Mr. Clinton described the actions of the Indonesian military as simply unacceptable. He called for an international peacekeeping force to help restore order. The United Nations says Indonesian troops did nothing to stop militias from entering the UN compound today in Dili. They damaged equipment and threatened East Timorese refugees inside. In Jakarta, NPR's Eric Weiner has more.
Indonesia is coming under a lot of pressure from many different directions. The U.S., of course, has suspended all military ties with Indonesia. Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain say they are reviewing their policy of military cooperation with Indonesia. There are threats of trade sanctions, and the IMF and World Bank are threatening to withhold nearly $7 billion in international aid. So clearly, a lot of pressure in the